you know, I had a student in 12th night come up to me and say, you know, the way Hamlet was forced on me, I hated Shakespeare. And I wish I could say that was the only time I've heard that.
Welcome to Story Power, a new bi-monthly podcast where my guests and I geek out about the stories we're passionate about. My name is Lucinda Sage Midgordon, and I started this podcast during the COVID-19 pandemic. As I watched the reaction of my social media circle, I noticed that many people turn to stories for comfort and help in making sense of the craziness going on around them. And as all good stories do, the world got even crazier. But as Neil Gaiman says, fairy tales are more than true, not because they tell us that dragons exist, but because they tell us that dragons can be beaten. Since I believe that stories have the power to show us the way and give us courage to keep going, I wanted to see if that was true for my guests as well. And what better place to begin than with one of the world's best storytellers, William Shakespeare. Today, I'm talking with my friend Dave Dahl, a theater professional who has studied Shakespeare enough to know that his stories are still relevant today. You're listening to episode number one. Welcome, Dave.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
I wanted to tell our listeners, you and I met 2 years ago in 2018 when I was getting ready to direct Measure for Measure at the local college where I teach. And I got this email from you that said that you had done it 7 times and you loved that play and that you wanted to help. Now, normally I would not have responded probably, but the fact that you had done the play 7 times and I had never directed a Shakespeare play before made me answer your email. But I never asked you, how did you find out about me directing Measure for Measure?
You know, it's funny. A mutual friend, Gabe Gaster, he told me you were directing it and that if I wanted to start to make ties in this community, I should reach out and just offer to help, even if it's just in a limited way, like doing dramaturgy or something like that. Because one of the things that had not happened for me yet was I had not really built a community here because I traveled so much.
Because you know, you're a theater professional.
Right. But also just because I had never, you know, really put in the effort. And suddenly I realized he was right, that one of the best things I could do was build a community here at home. I saw that as an opportunity, and he encouraged me. You just offered to help pre-plan or to do some dramaturgy or to just give some ideas and some pitfalls of the show with your experience. And so, you know, I under a friend's gentle direction, I thought it would be a good thing to try. And I you know, it was one of those magical things because, you know, you're right. Most people suddenly get an offer like that and they're like, who the heck is this? But you know, you were very receptive to it. And it that first conversation, I walked away more excited about that show than almost anything. So, yeah, it was a great first meeting, too.
Yeah, it was. And we've been collaborating ever since. And so now we're colleagues at the college, and I got to help you with 12th Night.
Yes.
So that was so fun. And I really appreciated your help because even though I love Measure for Measure, I knew it needed to be cut. I didn't know how to do it. But the fact that I learned over as we talked that you have been studying Shakespeare for a while. And this first episode, I was thinking there are so many stories that are still around centuries later, and Shakespeare happens to have a bunch of them. And you've studied Shakespeare, so I was hoping that you would talk a little bit about maybe one or two of your favorite plays and why you even started studying him. What was it about him that made you so jazzed? So just, do you want to talk about
sure.
that?
For me, the love of Shakespeare started when I was 6 years old. I grew up in Los Alamos and in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and they had a PBS station that was a little more free form and a little more experimental. They were willing to try different things. Of course, again, this was the early 70s too, where experimentation was the norm.
Yeah.
And one night they were showing this wonderful, wonderful movie. It was by Orson Welles called Chimes at Midnight. And it was a movie that he worked on throughout his life. And the sound was awful because he couldn't afford to do it properly. But the expressions, the relationships, the voices, and basically Chimes at Midnight is him compressing Richard II, Henry IV Part I, Henry IV Part II, and just the beginning of Henry V into one film.
Oh my goodness.
And this is where it really hooked me, was because it's really about this young man and his relationship between these two older men that are both his teachers, they're his fathers. Well, you know, his father is the king, Henry IV, mm-hmm. and Falstaff is the person that in life teaches you to have a good time and, you know, maybe a little excessively. but it's this relationship. And one of the things that I remember most about Chimes at Midnight was there was this scene where throughout most of the Henry series, Falstaff keeps talking about, he doesn't know what people are talking about. He's not old. He's a young man. He fits in with all the other hip, cool kids. And there's this profound moment. He's with this other prostitute character named Dahl Tershey. And they're having this frank and honest conversation. And there's this moment. And then he looks at her and says, and with Orson Welles, just that profound, deep voice, "I'm old. I'm old." And he accepts that reality that he is an old man. It just hooked me in something, way that I didn't even understand it necessarily because I was six, but it's hooked me in a way that I've never forgotten. And that's it. That's one of those stories that is another one. I mean, I think part of the reason why Shakespeare has endured it, yes, the language is beautiful, but there's a reason. I mean, of course, you know, now Pat, with the epidemic and the closure, both Patrick Stewart and another friend of mine named Terry are doing recordings of Shakespeare's sonnets, all, you know, all of them. But we don't stage Shakespeare's sonnets, you know, very often. But we plays, and I think part of the reason is, it's because, above all, they are about feeling, and they are about relationships. Now, granted, on a grand scale, but who doesn't understand the relationship between the dad you have and the one you secretly want? Well, and also, you know, one of the other things is the generational conflicts, you know. There are several moments in many of Shakespeare's plays where the younger characters often kind of roll their eyes and say, "Okay, boomer." And Henry IV is one of them. Hamlet is another one where you have Polonius who speaks. We're to make fun of him, okay, because he speaks in a very methodical point-counterpoint solution. But that is how his generation spoke, especially if you were educated and intelligent. But to his kids, it's, yeah, okay, boomer. Neither a borrower nor a lender, be great. Even Queen Gertrude has a moment where she looks at him and says, "More matter, less art."
Oh, yeah. I relate to what you're saying about being young and getting hooked on stories, because actually I had the father that I wanted. And mm-hmm. we moved around a lot, lived in a lot of really small towns, and didn't have movie theaters or only the school library for entertainment. So our entertainment was television. And when we would watch movies or sometimes television shows, my dad always, "Well, so what did you think of the movie? Oh, I liked it. Well, what did you like about it?" I mean, he would just keep asking questions and questions until finally, over the years, we would have these deep discussions about the themes of the movie and the characters and so on and so forth. And so classic movies kind of became my gateway, like Shakespeare, like that Orson Welles movie was for you, into mm-hmm. stories. And then I started to realize, you know, over the years, how many of those classic movies, and then when I studied Shakespeare in undergraduate and graduate school, that Shakespeare, the Greek plays, they have so many universal themes, things that we can relate to, even though they were written so long ago. And I like that you said emotions, because I didn't really ever identify that before, but I think that's right. It's the emotions that the characters are experiencing, not just what they're going through, but how they're feeling about what they're going through, that link us to those stories. So I was wondering, do you have a favorite or a couple of favorite Shakespeare plays?
Oh, goodness. Well, you know, just to return to a theme, I think the Henry IV plays and Richard II are probably among my favorites. Mm-hmm. Now, that sounds like a surprise, but the Henry IV plays are, with part one and part two, are about this really at core. Yes, there's some elements of history involved, but only in the most loose sense. I mean, he took liberties and shortened things and added people that weren't alive during this. But at its core, it's really about this father-son relationship. Henry IV does not approve of his son. In fact, at the end of Richard II, he talks about him. Has any man seen my unthrifty son? Hal is, you know, spending all his time with Falstaff, carousing in the taverns. What the father doesn't see is that his son is learning his people. But he still loves Hal, even still. There's a moment where, even in part one, where he's still angry at him, where he says, "Win, Harry, win. Have I not seen thee since and shall not see thee again?" You know, where you actually see that there's this level of care even then, and disappointment and love even then. And there's a moment in Henry IV, part one, it's early on in the play, Hal turns to the audience. See, this is the other reason I love Shakespeare, is that idea of the fourth wall, the invisible curtain between actor and audience. Mm-hmm. It could not exist in that theater and in that day and age, because the theater was a public spectacle forum. I mean, you had people of all classes. You had prostitutes selling their wares. You had orange sellers. I mean, can you imagine a quiet moment in Shakespeare in that environment? No, it didn't exist. You had to hook and grab and hold your audience by speaking to them directly. Yeah. And there's this wonderful moment in Henry IV, part one, where he says, "I know you all, and will for a little while uphold this appearance." And he warns the audience. He says, "Look, this is not always going to be this way. There will come a day where I have to step out of this and leave it behind." Now, don't get me wrong. For the rest of that play, he hangs on to that world. In the next one, he starts to leave it. And then there's this moment where Falstaff shows up at his coronation. He hasn't taken the warnings. He hasn't taken the attention, and he says, "Hal, my joy, my Jove." And there's this awful moment where Hal has now become Henry V, and he looks at him and says, "I know thee not, old man, fall to thy prayers." But it's a shattering moment, because it was written in a way that you're going with Falstaff, the audience. The middle to lower classes, their sympathy was going to be more towards Falstaff. So when that happens, I'm just picturing stone silence in the theater. Mm-hmm. And for those times, it was something. I mean, can you imagine the opening moments of Hamlet? You know, Hamlet's about to do his first major speech to the audience, and there's a guy selling oranges in the theater. "Oh, that this too solid flesh, oranges!" I really have to say this again?
Well, while you were talking about that, you know, I don't think I'm going to refer to something that's going on right now about the whole Harry and Meghan thing, about everybody's being so all up in arms about Harry and Meghan walking away from their royal duties. But I would imagine, although I might be totally wrong, that to be a member of a royal family and have all those responsibilities and have the protocol that you have to go through, I could see that why Hal would want to rebel against that.
Oh, yes, definitely. There's a moment where, you know, this goes back to Richard II, weirdly enough. He's basically exiled Henry IV, and that character's name is Henry Bolingbroke. and he's stolen Bolingbroke's land. And Bolingbroke comes back, and slowly nobles start gathering to his side. All he wants is Richard to release his lands. At least that's what he says in the beginning. And this is a director's dilemma. Do you believe him? Well, I do, because there's a moment where it's not until Richard puts the idea in his head, and he puts the idea in his head very early on. So it kind of becomes this weird suicide by cop in a way. And then you get into Henry IV, part one, where at the end of Richard II, Richard is murdered because of something offhanded Bolingbroke says. And you, again, that's a matter of interpretation. You can interpret it that he said it so he couldn't be tied to it. Again, my preference is that it was something offhanded, because at the end, Bolingbroke is horrified that the king's been murdered, and he decides to go on a pilgrimage to Jerusalem. Well, no sooner than you get into Henry IV, part one, all these people, these allies that have come together to help put him on the throne, they're now fracturing, and he can't take his pilgrimage to Jerusalem. He can't atone for the taking the crown and then unwillingly or wittingly participating in the murder of this king. So there's this guilt that starts with him that he can't take this pilgrimage, and that he must hold it.
Yeah, he has to stay and put the country back together.
Yeah, he does. And then, you know, you look at it from a father's point of view. If your only son is, he has two sons in the play. John, who's much more responsible, but he's the younger one. And then you have, Harry, who's being this party animal and tearing up the kingdom. I think many times he wonders, dear God, this was not worth it, you know? Yeah. And he compares the son of one of his rebelling lords to being this paragon, and he compares his children, and there's this moment of heartbreak for him that his son can't be as good as Hotspur, who's this dutiful and intense and accomplished warrior. Anyway, it's one of those plays that I've always loved and always will. But, you know, Shakespeare, you know, a lot of people praise his stories. But here's the thing. The only original story, or at least we can't find attributions to, is The Tempest. The rest of them were all lifted from other stories, like All's Well That Ends Well was taken liberally from Boccaccio's Decameron. Measure for Measure has several sources and several stories. But the way he put it together, focusing on the feelings of these characters, focusing on the idea of what sexual harassment is 400 years before we ever really started to use that term.
Yes, right. But I think that borrowing is, and then making something new out of it, is one of the best things you can do as a creator. I find myself doing that all the time when I'm writing, I hook an idea on something that I read before and hook it to something that I watched, some movie that I watched. I have this realization about the characters and myself. And to me, that's what Shakespeare was doing. He was saying, here's this ancient story, and this is what's happening now, and this is what I'm getting out of it, out of those two things. So, yeah, the reason I did Measure for Measure was because it was shortly after the Harvey Weinstein thing.
Oh, yeah.
Actually, I think I wanted to do it before the story broke, but it was not very long after. Because at first I was thinking, do I really want to direct a Shakespeare play? I've never directed a Shakespeare play before. And then when the Harvey Weinstein thing happened, I said, I have to do it.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's a passage in Measure for Measure. It's not just Isabel's, to whom would I tell this, who would believe me? It's an echo of what Angelo says to her just moments before, where he says, who will believe thee, Isabel?
Yes.
Where he talks about the character of his outward life being held up to public scrutiny.
Everyone believed him to be above reproach.
Well, yeah. I mean, again, he's an interesting character to me, because the first thing he does when he appears on stage is he tries to talk the Duke out of this. He doesn't just accept it. He tries to talk his way out of it. Now, again, there's a directorial. See, this is the other beautiful thing about why I love Shakespeare. There's no stage direction instructing you how to feel about this, how to approach it. So it's very open to interpretation. Some interpretations may be, well, he's just doing that as a deflection so he doesn't appear egotistical. Or he's doing it because there's a sincere need not to take this position because he knows he's not fit for it. There's a myriad of approaches you can take. And the interesting thing to me is how the director and the actor have to find what that means.
Right.
Now, the director has to know it first, but then the actor, as they fit themselves into it, they can then inform you what it truly is about for them and synthesize the two visions together. But the director piece is telling this story, fitting it to the world, creating a concept, how it moves on stage, how it looks, does it read? Is it telling the story that I want to tell? And then you have the actor coming along and having to live in that emotionally and physically. And hopefully the two mesh, which yours did beautifully, by the way.
Oh, well, it's because you helped. But the thing that I love, too, about that play and about Shakespeare is he gives you clues in the lines.
Yes.
That you can ignore or you can emphasize. And the two women, Isabel and, is it Marianne?
Yep, Marianne.
Those two women are so powerful because they are the voice of forgiveness. And you wouldn't think that in that kind of situation that forgiveness would be possible. And maybe, you know, maybe we haven't got there quite yet, but I think forgiveness is a really important thing that we're going to have to address in the Me Too, Time's Up movement. Is, yes, these men have to be held accountable, but also we have to forgive them because we've created a culture in this world where men just think they can do anything they want. And, you know, women standing up and saying, oh, no, sorry, no. And that's what Isabella and Marianne do, is they stand up and say, no. But then in the end, they forgive Angelo, which is so interesting.
Well, I agree with you. For me, there's a moment in the show that I think is breathtaking, where Mariana turns to Isabella and then directly asks her to intercede on Angelo's behalf, which she does. And then she never says another word after that. She does the intercession. She steps in. But then she never speaks again. It's really interesting.
That is interesting. Especially since she wants to be a nun. And then the Duke asks her to marry him. And it's left at the hanging at the end. Is she going to say yes? Is she going to say no?
Which, you know, for me is, let's talk about the Duke. I mean, a lot of people think he's a wonderful character. And I'm, you know, one of my problems and my biases as a director for a show like this is how do I reconcile with this guy? Because he admits freely he's allowed his country to be very lax and the rule of law has gone down. He puts Angelo in, knowing who he is or who he outwardly appears to be, which is an upright, moral man who will set the country back. But then he does it so he doesn't have to be hated for it. Which our culture won't get this one as much, but it's a bad deal. He bribes another priest, another friar, to dress up as a friar. And in that vein, he hears confessions, which, unbelievable. You're not supposed to do that. He directly intervenes by having, you know, this is actually a famous trope at the time. It was called the bed trick. The Duke is just expecting this old trick to work where Mariana will dress up as Isabella, go in there and sleep with Angelo, and then everything will be okay. What the Duke does not take into account is Angelo's true inner character.
Oh,
so as
yeah.
soon as the bed trick happens, does Angelo suddenly be okay and think it's all... No, he gets terrified that the whole thing's going to come out. So he speeds up the execution of Isabella's brother. But there is one moment that redeems the Duke and made me sort of have to rethink how I would approach this with an actor. One of his oldest counselors, Aeschylus, says he was a man above all who sought to know himself. And that opened up a whole nother line of thought about him, that maybe he's a little not as manipulative or as twisted as I think he is. And, you know, it's right after it's in the famous jail cell scene where Lucio has just lambasted him and told a lot of lies about him. And then Aeschylus, in turn, who's the oldest counselor, who's watched how things grow, who disapproves of what Angelo is doing, says to the Duke, he was a man above all who sought to know himself. And in that one line, all of my, I still have some strong reservations about this guy, about the Duke. But that one moment sort of hinged things out. And then you look at other characters that are in this world. Now, whether the Duke appointed them or his father, it doesn't matter. The people that actually run this world disapprove of Angelo's severity. And Measure for Measure is, again, you know, what you do, you shall receive in equal abundance. Measure response for measured action. So it's right out of the Sermon on the Mount. And the play is all about, how do you balance the scales of society? How do you balance the scales of justice? What even is justice anyway?
Well, one of the things that I felt about the Duke the very first time I saw the play, because we got to see the Kate Nelligan, I think Tim Pickett Smith was in it.
Oh, yeah.
In the 70s. And the one thing I felt about the Duke, the way they portrayed him in that, was that he dressed up like this monk so he could go around and find out what was actually in the minds of the people. That's the way I took it at that time. And so when I directed it and read it again, yes, I'm not Catholic, so it's okay, he's taking confession. But yeah, you're right. For a Catholic, that would be, oh my gosh, that would be maybe a mortal sin. But to me, he's trying to find out a balance, because yes, things have gone to hell in a handbasket in his city. But like Aeschylus says, he's trying to find a way to rein things in and to get things back on track without being so like Angelo ends up being. I think he thinks Angelo's going to do things in a different way. And then Angelo is condemning people to death. Yeah, he's cruel. Right. Yeah.
Well, also, it's disproportionate retribution. I mean, by the way, what the brother Claudio is accused of, Shakespeare actually did.
Yeah, I know. Right.
The brother is accused of, the marriage between Claudio and Juliet has been all but done. The civil ceremony was done, but she got pregnant before they did the church ceremony. So there were two parts to marriage.
Right.
There was the civil contract, and then you would go to the church and formalize the contract.
I thought that there was some holdup between the two.
There is. Her dowry hasn't, in doubt, which was a stupid thing to worry about, but also, well, it really wasn't, it derailed their actual marriage. But they were married in everything but the church ceremony.
Yes.
Now, I mean, oh, and by the way, there's an old story about this. I love this play for many, many reasons, but one of them is, you know, First Folios, the 1623 First Folio, when it was published, was revolutionary. It probably saved Shakespeare, because all of the 37 plays that we consider quote unquote canonical were in that First Folio. Well, Measure for Measure, there was a Jesuit priest that owned a folio, and he took a razor and cut out Measure for Measure from his folio. But the reality was, this play deals with so many issues of not just sexual harassment or Me Too, but it also deals with sex discussed through euphemism. I'll never forget reading this at 15 and going, because, you know, euphemism are how we get around certain topics.
Yes.
And one of the ones that just caught me at 15, and I got the giggles, and my English teacher thought I was screwing around, And she goes, what? And I said, you read this? Where they ask what Claudio's offense is. And Lucio says, groping for trout in a peculiar stream.
Yes. Shakespeare does that kind of euphemism a lot.
Oh, yeah. He absolutely does. Mercutio and Romeo and Juliet. He runs like a fool longing to put his bauble into a hole. I mean, it's coarse, powerful stuff. But, you know, then again, that's designed to appeal to all members of your audience. When you're writing, I mean, think about this. You know, most writers write for a niche nowadays.
Yes.
But think about this. The beauty of Shakespeare is that it is for everyone. And it's really important not to lose sight of that. And our society has so much bias because a certain segment has kind of co-opted Shakespeare, that it's too highbrow, that it's too intellectual, that it's too, and you know what? It's to the advantage of that elite to do that. And I have real problems with it because, again, that's not who he did write for that population, but he also wrote for the guy that lived down the street that works in the mine. And in fact, in the 19th century, workmen knew Shakespeare. It was his devices, his rhetoric. It was a common thing. And there would be often, you know, conflicting theater productions. There would be the one for the working man and the one for the upper 1%. In fact, one of the biggest riots in American history was over two productions of Macbeth happening at the same time.
Really? When?
It would have been in the 1880s, I believe. And it was, they had brought this famous English actor over, a guy named MacReady. Mm-hmm. And also, so the other thing is our style of acting, it didn't exist. The theaters at the time were designed to hold a larger number of people. The more realistic, naturalistic style that we have now did not exist. I mean, it was more like lyricism. You hear like the actors almost sing their phrases to carry them.
Yeah, I was thinking it was more oratory than...
Yeah, but also there was a style of speaking called declamation.
Oh, right.
It was more like speak singing, almost. Mm-hmm. And some of it, I played some of it for actors before, and they were almost crying with laughter. But so what happened was there was also a blue-collar production of Macbeth, and the two were in conflict. They opened virtually at the same time, and MacReady was set to open his, and people were encouraged to stay away, you know, if you weren't part of this upper crust. And so some lower class, you know, the ones that were supporting the other show broke into that production and started fights, and then that spilled out onto the streets. And
oh my goodness.
Yeah, no, I mean, but that's an example of Shakespeare being for everyone in a negative way. But for the most part, that didn't happen. For the most part, people of all classes were encouraged to know it. And, yeah. You know, I think there's nothing that does more harm than exposing people to Shakespeare at not too young an age, but in a way that doesn't get them to love it. I had a student in Twelfth Night come up to me and say, you know, the way Hamlet was forced on me, I hated Shakespeare. And I wish I could say that was the only time I've heard that. It was never meant to be read silently. And I know there are people that do that, but they're rare and they've developed their taste for it over years. But honestly, I feel like you always go back to the story. What story are we telling? What story is this in this play? And then how do I open it up for people to come to? And we just did Twelfth Night recently, and that was a joy to put together and realize how all the different problems in the play and how we could handle them, you know, based on just experientially walking through it with the cast. I love that experience.
Yes, it was fun to watch. I was just helping out, make sure you had your rooms, and I was just producing it, but I loved watching the development of it and the how the actors started to understand, oh, this is what my character is going through. This is what my character is feeling right now. And, you know, that's why when I was taking my Shakespeare classes, this was way back in the 70s, they had long playing records. It would be an audiobook now, but I would check those out of the library. I would get my book and I would sit down and listen to the actors saying the lines. It was probably recorded from a performance. And then I would follow along. And that's how I really got hooked on Shakespeare, was listening to the interaction of the characters and how they felt and the story themes. Sometimes the upper class characters had a similar theme to the ones of the lower class characters, but the way they were playing out was different, a little bit different.
Very much so. Yes, very much so.
And so, and it all went together in the overall play. When we did Measure for Measure, we cut out a lot of the lower class characters because we didn't have a lot of rehearsal time. And so you helped those characters playing those lower class characters, body language and, you know, it was sort of like, hey, dude, and slapping hands, you know, which made it come alive. And you did the same thing with Twelfth Night. And that's why when I do teach dramatic structure, I use the version of Taming of the Shrew that I use, because it's the same kind of thing. They're active on the stage. The director was very, very deliberate about stopping at certain moments to show the characters connecting and getting it in their head that, oh, something has changed here. And that points it out to the audience as well. So, and I'm so grateful for Kenneth Branagh for his productions, his movie productions of Shakespeare, because I think that that makes them come alive more. That's why I loved helping you with Twelfth Night, and I was so grateful that you helped me with Measure for Measure, because we need to, you know, help people see these plays have universal themes. They have themes that, like you were talking about earlier, fathers and sons, women who I talk about this in Taming of the Shrew when we're doing it for dramatic structure. Kate has a real reason to be so angry. Her father loves her sister more than he loves her. So it's not, you know, she's not just being angry to be angry because that's the name of the play, Taming of the Shrew. She's angry for a real reason. And she's going about it in the wrong way. She's trying to get her father's love in the wrong way. But I think that that's one of the things I like about Petruchio. I think at some point he realizes, oh, she has a real reason to be angry, but we got to break her of this habit. So it's like this psychological thing before psychology is even thought about.
For me, there's also a profound profundity to Shrew that I think a lot of people don't talk about. Negative attention is still attention. For me, okay, this is going to sound very weird, but I found a feral kitten many years ago. And the only way she knew how to respond was either through fear or through attack. And it took about 8 weeks. There was no breaking, though. It just took time and patience and willing to teach her games to get her to start opening up a little bit, and just a little bit of holding time a day where I'd wrap her up in a towel. She didn't like that part. She hated it. But then once she got onto my arms or into my lap, then she would settle down. It took about 3 months before she became a mellower and easier being, a happier being. And there's this moment where it wasn't I had to break her of being wild. I had to show her she could trust other people. She could trust me. And there is a feralness to Kate that also has preserved her in the society that, if you look at most of the characters in the play, especially the wooers of Bianca, they are detestable human beings.
Oh, they are.
And there's a reason that Kate doesn't treat them well.
Well, even the
And in fact, one of my favorite versions of this show is they gender swapped everything. The overall tone was very interesting. seeing a man wrap his head around that final speech is a lot of the same problems that women today have around that final speech.
Yes.
You know, to me, that's one of the most problematic plays in Shakespeare.
You're right, though. Even, who is it that Bianca marries, ends up marrying?
No, he is a problem, because even he's got some ulterior motive for doing it.
Yeah, and he doesn't honor his father. He just, or her father, or her. They get married in secret, and then spring it on their parents, and it's like, wait a minute, that's not honorable. At least Petruchio, even though he went about it in a really weird way with his outfit at the wedding and all of that, he went about it in the way that it was honored in their society. He went to the father, arranged for the marriage, he even met with her to tell her that he wanted to marry her. And I love that whole fight scene, because the way it's done in the production that I show in Dramatic Structure, it's obvious they are attracted to each other immediately.
Yes.
But she, you know, she's so used to being angry all the time that she just fights him tooth and nail the whole way. But it shows how she really, when he doesn't show up for the wedding on time, she's devastated.
Yes.
And
public shame. Yes.
Yeah. And in a way, she might be, that might be twofold. It's public shame, but it's also, oh, I liked him. I wanted to be married to him. And now he's not showing up. What's going on here? Of course, that's up to the director and the actors. Yeah. So we only have a few more minutes. But if you were going to suggest a Shakespeare play for people to start with, which one would it be?
I would say go with the comedy. I would go with Much Ado About Nothing, just because it's built for a multi-range of actors and abilities. And we can talk more about that in a bit. But, you know, just real quick about True. Even in its day, it was questionable how far it went, because a few years later, after Shakespeare retired, one of his side writers, a guy named John Fletcher, turned around and wrote a play called The Tamer Tame, where Petruchio tries the same things again, and it doesn't go so well.
Mm.
So this play was controversial even in its time, to the point where, you know, one of his co-writers turned around and did a sequel based more about Petruchio being tamed to his wife, Mariah. So that's an interesting one. But back to Much Ado About Nothing. Not even the same style of play. It's a romantic comedy. Yes, it has a few minor heavy things in it, but there's a layer of protection in there in that the audience knows what's genuinely happening,
yes.
Whereas a lot of the characters don't.
Yes, I was going to pick that one too. And partly the reason I wanted to pick that one is because of the dual relationships between Benedict and Beatrice and Hero and Claudio, and the difference between, it's showing the difference between the two relationships.
Yeah, it's also a play about maturity.
Exactly, yes. And I love the way Kenneth Branagh did it. I mean, he was a genius to bring in all those American actors to act with the British actors. And he made it fun and alive. And that's the way I think Shakespeare's supposed to be. I don't think it's supposed to be oratory. I think it's supposed to be.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, one of my favorite productions of it dealt with Benedict and Beatrice being much older than the others. And it was sort of their last chance. And it made the stakes higher. And I had two lovely senior actors, Benedict and Beatrice. Mm-hmm. Well, we had that when I wasn't directing it. I was dramaturging and assisting it. Mm-hmm. And doing text work. I was the text coach for that one. And we had a much older Benedict and Beatrice. And let me tell you, the stakes of the story took off. It's not written that way. It's written to be that they're, you know, maybe 5 to 10 years older than Claudio and Hero. or maybe they're like 30. But
that would be old in that time period to not be married.
Weirdly enough, by the time you get into Elizabethan and late early Jacobean society, with the middle class emerging and the tradesmen guilds emerging, the life expectancy, it actually expanded considerably. The overall life expectancy went up because you had this middle class. You had a greater number of people having a little more money, a little more resources than before, where there was a huge disparity. And suddenly, you know, with the invention of the Caxton Press coming along in 1454, suddenly you could print books much more easily and much more quickly. The printing press may have been one of the few inventions. Yeah, everybody knows about Gutenberg, but a guy named Caxton introduced it to England during the War of the Roses in 1454, and its impact on the society was revolutionary. Suddenly, people began to learn to read. Suddenly, schooling became less about, this is how you farm, to this is how you live. This is how other people do. This is our stories, our value. Yeah. Suddenly our stories go from an oral tradition or a pictorial tradition into a verbal and that from you can read from a book. You can pick it up. You can tell a story. In fact, there would be guys sitting in the audience handwriting the play they were seeing, turning around, doing some edits, taking it to a printer, and then handing that out to their actors to do. You know, that's why that's why we talk about, you know, if you get into Shakespeare scholarship, and please don't. It'll drive you insane the first few weeks. But they talk about things like bad quartos and Q4 has this line.
Yeah, I'm not the scholarly type. I'm more about the emotional part of the story. What is going on emotionally with the characters? So I probably won't study Shakespeare like you do in terms of, you know, where the source material came from and all that. But I'm interested in looking at the plays and what is going on with the characters.
And sometimes that source material can inform choices, but that's where the rehearsal period comes through. That's where the table work process comes through. And table work is just where you sit down with the actor and walk through the character by beat. Sometimes it's not that tedious, but sometimes it is. It has to be. And it sounds less fun than it is. Actually, it's a lot of fun. To lay this out.
Yeah, I think that really helped when we did Measure for Measure, to sit down and read it and talk about, well, what is going on with, why is this character saying this thing right here? What's going on in their head, in their heart? Why are they doing what they're doing? And that's the thing about stories that I always got from my dad was, everybody has a reason for doing what they do in real life. And in the story. And it's my job to figure out why, okay, there's something behind that. What's going on? And so that helped me in real life as well, is, oh, this person's doing this thing. I wonder what's going on underneath that.
Yes. Beauty, you know, and you just described picture book definition of subtext. The other piece is, for most actors, for any play, this is important, but especially with Shakespeare, why am I using this word now? Why am I saying this way? Then it's our job to understand the definitions, because sometimes there's also a lot of ambiguity and irony in Shakespeare, that what they mean on the surface may not be what's under that wording. And then it's our job to figure that out and put it together.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. To me, studying stories is studying human behavior, the deeper parts of being a human. And why we do what we do and why we say what we do.
And absolutely.
Yeah. So I am so happy that you and I got to have this conversation.
Likewise. I hope we get to do it again sometime.
Well, since we're collaborating, I'm sure we will. I'm just not sure we'll have it recorded. but thanks for being here.
Anytime.
I hope you enjoyed the show. If you liked what you heard, please share it with a friend and give us a review on your favorite podcast app. It will help people find us. You'll find the show notes for this episode at my website, Sage Woman Chronicles, at sagewoman.life. You can leave a comment there. And remember, as Philip Pullman said, after nourishment, shelter, and companionship, stories are the things we need most in the world. Until next time, this is Lucinda Sage Midgordon. Thanks for listening.